Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with My Opel, rewarding loyalty and taking care of members.
The rise of the far right across the world is the subject of a book called How to Stop Fascism. The author is writer and activist Paul Mason, the former economics editor of Channel 4 News. He joins us now on the line from London. Pleasure to talk to you, Paul. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. You start the book with quite a provocative thought experiment. You give the Nazis a time machine to come and join us now. What would they conclude if they did turn up?
Good morning, Philip, and thanks for having me. Yes, I mean, when I was when I had that thought, it was, you know, one of the places I didn't think they'd find very interesting was the Republic of Ireland, in the sense that you know what I'm saying there is, look, the Nazis arrive in 2020, and they've been sent via time machine to restart, you know, a Fourth Reich. When they get here, I mean, they realize that the short summary of the intro to the book is that, you know, the mission was superfluous. We have already got a second fascism. It is very different to the one they would have known, but it is here. And anybody who's, you know, I mean, I think I've been just, you know, remembering that, you know, in the last Doyle election in your country, I think 1% of people were worried about immigration. Okay, so, you know, we're starting from a very low platform here. But during the COVID-19 pandemic, we've seen, indeed, you know, QAnon, we've seen anti-vax protests, we've seen anti-lockdown protests, which, hey presto, suddenly there is a far right in the Republic of Ireland. And it's one that policymakers, I think, are now right to be worrying about. And worrying about, well, what's the link between them and the much more, you know, obvious places in the world that have had this problem for decades?
You know what we actually need to do at the start of this conversation? I think it's agree a working definition of what a fascist looks like in 2021, because they don't obligingly wear those natty Hugo Boss designed grey uniforms any longer, do they?
No. But what the one caution I would say, and this is one of the themes of the book, definitions are not explanations. In addition, definitions can trap you when reality is very fluid. But you know, you ask me what does a fascist look like? The core belief system for them is the so-called Great Replacement Theory. That is that immigration is causing what they call a genocide of the white race. So that migrants mix with existing people, and this is going to lead to the wiping out of something they call the white race. Now, feminism is almost their co-equal sort of target, because they see feminism as the problem, suppressing the birth rate, giving women reproductive rights. They see all forms of liberalism, feminism, human rights, universality, you know, in thinking about human beings as closet forms of Marxism, and their ultimate aim, and this is what does distinguish them from your common or garden sort of, you know, right-wing populist, their ultimate aim is a global ethnic civil war, which produces what we call ethnic monostates, you know, states in which there is only one ethnicity, one language, one kind of person, and they're not too worried about what happens to people who don't fit into that. So that is what we're dealing with.
So if you want to spot a fascist, ask them their thoughts on immigration, ask them their thoughts on gender equality as a starting point.
Yeah, and above all, you know, the tell is the series of overestimations and hyperboles that are there. That anybody could say, you know, it would be a reasonable proposition to come on your show and have an argument that there's too much immigration. I don't agree with that, but if somebody says that to me, I'll listen to them and hear what
they're... It doesn't make them a fascist.
Absolutely. But if they say immigration is white genocide, and you'll get callers into radio programs doing this, they'll say, you know, immigration is wiping us out. That's not just a kind of prejudice. It's a theory. And my concern in writing the book is finding how many people actually subscribe to that theory without presenting the overt forms, you know, the swastika on the armband, or the sort of, even the QAnon sweatshirt. The problem is how logical and coherent the new fascist theory is. And one thing, how how adjacent to nationalism it is. Because we, those of us who studied fascism, you know, in the in its first form, you know, the classic academic definition is it's ultranationalism. It's violent ultranationalism. Well, you know, there were people on, for example, in the Republican movement in your country who would tell me, well, we've, you know, there won't be an Irish fascism because nationalism is expressed through a progressive series of progressive parties. Okay, well, you could accept that. But fascism is no longer just nationalism. It's ethno-nationalism, and it's very, very focused, therefore, on anti-feminism and indeed misogyny. There is a hatred of women. Which just wasn't there in the mix at the same level in, you know, in Mussolini and Hitler's politics.
Yeah, one of the really interesting things that you identify here is that you have a number of different types of people on the right who have all started to make kind of common cause or coalesce. You have conservative authoritarians, that kind of, you know, world has gone to pot and we need to rewind the clock type of person. Then you have right-wing populists and their supporters, Trumpy types, as well as far-right extremists, you know, the skinheads and their apologists. Yep. And they are making common cause, now you say. Give us examples of that.
Okay, so I mean, the personal example I would give is that during the prorogation crisis, when Boris Johnson tried to shut down the British Parliament, illegally as it turned out, many of us were on the streets, you know, the classic middle-class person who wanted to remain in the European Union, very polite, demonstrating with a little European flag, suddenly turns up, what? A demonstration called by UKIP. Okay, so UKIP is, I would say, a right-wing populist party. It stood in elections. It got 4 million votes. If it was fascist, we'd have to be worried. Okay, the demonstration was there to support Boris Johnson. The people on the demonstration were chanting Boris Johnson, Boris, good old Boris, and all this. They were also chanting the name of Tommy Robinson, who is one of the number one far right extremists in the UK. And when people came up to me to basically try and surrounded me, poking me in the chest and the rest of it, what they were shouting was, Paul Mason, Marxist, traitor to your country. Now, that tells you that they, in the heads of those people, there is a very definite and theorized fascism. I couldn't identify who they were, but they were the same kind of people that turned
out. People like you on the left are identified as being cultural Marxists.
Cool. Well, you see, I am a Marxist. And for me, Marxism is a form of social scientific research project. It postulates certain things about history, and we try and find out whether that's true.
Yeah,
with no disrespect
to your views, I can't imagine that they're that widely known within UKIP circles that you unashamedly put your hands up and say, I am a Marxist.
Yeah, this is what's happened in the space of my lifetime. I was, as the book explains, I was an active anti-fascist in the 1970s and 80s. And as part of that, sometimes you went undercover and stood in the middle of a crowd of far-right people with swastikas on their arms or their lapel badges. They were not irrationalists. They had, you know, often they were the sons or grandsons of people who'd been fascist in the 30s. The pubs they drank in were right-wing pubs going back decades. You could kind of say, well, their politics was based on prejudice. The politics of the people who tried to attack me on Whitehall was based on theory. It was a fully worked in. You know, when somebody like that, you know, very ill-educated, you know, from very probably low income, is worried about Marxism, what you know is that somebody has taught them this theory, this great replacement, anti-feminism, cultural Marxism, day X, okay. You know, the catastrophe.
And now this brings us then to the point of how it is that we deal with them, because your thesis is, as you've just said, and as you've just given an example of, is that we must place ourselves bodily between fascists and their goals. Now, I'm not saying that I'm right in this because I don't know, but there is a persuasive argument that an awful lot of time, left to their own devices and their own little sad protests, that these people cut a kind of a pathetic and a laughable figure, but that what elevates them, what gives them a new platform, what gives them relevance is when the counter, the anti-fascist protest turns up and it all kicks off.
Yeah, and what I've said in the book is that, though anti-fascist protest is justified. So just in the last weekend in Portland, Oregon, you know, there's a huge problem with the far right in the state of Oregon and the United States. There were people who refused to leave burning villages during the forest fires because they'd been captured by the far right and told the anti-fascism people were going to come and steal their stuff. Okay, so in Portland this weekend, about 70 far-right armed, you know, with in one case with a real gun, which he opened fire with, turned up. And that was the debate. You know, the city authorities said, we're keeping the police off the streets, we're keeping ourselves off the streets, let them go through, do what they want, and off they'll go. About 300 or 400 anti-fascists went out and stopped them, and there was a fight. And we still don't know whether or not that will pan out well, you know, in terms of some people thinking, well, you know, sort of the anti-fascists are just as bad or not. But the point is when they come to big black communities in the United States or even here in the United Kingdom, where I am, and have tried to do that, tried to take on the Black Lives Matter protesters, what we can't do is just say, well, run away. If we would have done that.
No, you can't in that context, Paul. But I'm wondering, because I'm thinking of our own far right copycat agent provocateurs in this country. When they are small little protests, like the ones that regularly take place outside RTE, where you have a couple of people with a banner denouncing everybody who works for the state broadcaster as paedophiles, are we not better to just leave them standing there in the rain by themselves?
I've a very strong argument in favour of discerning, of drawing lines between actual violent fascist genocide advocates and deluded people like the ones you're describing. I think we have to try and sort of, in general, just smother the voice that is advocating violence and genocide. That's the number one thing. However we do that, I mean, the book, you know, will be probably criticised by some of the people who are in the anti-fascist movement because of its emphasis on doing this through regulating social media and law, you know, so policing. When fascism, I mean, the problem we've got is that, I think we did in the 1980s, in the United Kingdom and other Western countries, suppress that fascism that was there. We contained it. It went in an electoral direction. It morphed into right-wing populism. Okay, today we just kind of physical protest is not going to stop millions of people subscribing to the ideas on Facebook and Telegram and the Discord channels of gaming communities. It's gone beyond that. And that's why in the book I've tried to turn the attention more onto what I call the thought architecture of fascism, taking it apart, presenting logical and scientifically and rationally based arguments against it. I think we're all going to have to be doing that for quite some time.
Okay, but is there not something else more fundamental here? Because would, frankly, the far right have gotten the foothold or the toehold with the disaffected sections of the population that it has if governments of the centre and governments of the left hadn't been so crap for those people in the course of the last 20 or 30 years?
Well, absolutely. I mean, my hometown in the northwest of England, Lee, I've seen the rise of the far right, of the populist right, and of a very, now very, very quite sort of confident racism and misogyny, political racism and misogyny. So you're on the streets. I'm a Labour Party member, can barely, sometimes and in some places, you can barely appear. Because there is such hostility. And that hostility, I think a lot of people think it comes from economic deprivation. Most of the evidence, and I think this is also true with studies that have been done in the Republic of Ireland, shows that it is not economic deprivation that is driving people to the right, no matter how crap their lives are. What it is the falling apart of a coherent ideology that explains the world. And I think I go into some detail about this. I call it the collapse of the neoliberal self. The self kind of created in the last 40 years around markets, around narcissism, around competition, was told that if you do these things, the classic Love Island kind of life strategy, if you do these things, you will prosper. And people have done them, and they know real since 2008, they obey the rules, and they don't prosper, and they don't feel happy, and nothing explains the world to them anymore. Now, if we look at the history of fascism, some of the sociologists studying Nazism in real time as it emerged, realized that this was a quasi-religious form of kind of mass psychology. And that I'm trying to resurrect that understanding, because I think the left have become far too focused on, well, you know, sort the economic problems out and this stuff goes away. It doesn't.
How to Stop Fascism by Paul Mason. Provocative, thought-provoking, and very, very entertaining, as always. Great to talk to you, Paul. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Philip. Good morning. Cheers.